You're listening to a WOSU Public Media podcast. Everything you hear is funded by listeners like you. Become a member of WOSU Public Media today and support digital content like Snollygoster and the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast. Make a gift at WOSU.org.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The GOP-controlled House last week voted to override Governor DeWine's veto of a bill that would shift, public health orders to state lawmakers, or the power of public health orders to state lawmakers. Democrats opposed the measure, and Democrat House Minority Leader Amelia Sykes of Akron, who has a master's degree in public health, explained why.
You all are great at a lot of things. You are brilliant orators, lawyers, business owners, farmers, and more, but you are not good at public health. And I dare any of you to debate me on that, because you can't. And I can tell, as you're smirking at me with your not wearing a mask, you are not good at public health. This is not your lane. You need to get out of it.
It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Julie Carr-Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning, Ann.
And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be with you, Ann.
And USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back, Jackie.
Good morning.
So, Jackie, that Senate Bill 22 they're talking about, it would enable lawmakers to overturn public health and emergency orders from the state and local health departments. Amelia Sykes, it was an interesting and assertion there. She offered that strong opposition. House Speaker Bob Kupp scolded her for that. What was that about?
Well, I think we've seen this before, too, when I think there's an informal rule that you don't attack your members. And I think that in this instance, he was maybe feeling that it was approaching that level. I mean, it was a very impassioned statement. And, you could, I think, make that argument on a lot of things that the legislature votes for, that they, you know, are not experts in the policy change that they are making. And, that was the main, I think that Leader Sykes drove it home probably the best of anybody, but that was the main point on the Democratic side of things is, you know, we should be leaving decisions like on public health matters to people who are experienced in public health.
Right. It's like the same idea is I'm not going to update my breaker box. I'm going to hire an electrician to do that because someone could get hurt, I think was kind of her point. You know, Julie Carr-Smythe, the governor kind of at the 11th hour sought some compromise. And it was kind of interesting how in your face they were about that, saying too little too late.
Right. And so what was interesting is that the DeWine camp had kind of conceded we will concede to the fact that this bill needs to address health orders, because one thing had been health shouldn't be on the table right now because obviously of the pandemic. But what they had said was that, you know, these would automatically expire after 60 days, you know, and so in the bill and will, like you say. So their idea was, let's have a mechanism for that. Let's have the committee hearing process, let's have you come back to the State House and take a vote on it at least, because, you know, this required proactive action by the governor to have to come back every 60 days and renew these.
And they just said, thanks, but no thanks.
Right. I mean,
they didn't
basically
even say thanks.
They were dug in completely on what they wanted to do here, which, you know, I mean, if you take it from their point of view, it is that they had literally no say in this. And, you know, they're getting hammered by their constituents about this. And they felt there was really no way for them to even have a voice as the state's lawmakers on that executive process.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and it's our weekly reporter roundtable, and we're talking about Senate Bill 22 would enable lawmakers to overturn public health and emergency orders by the executive branch. That was Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press also with us. Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Jackie Borchardt of she's the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief. So, Joe Ingles, what's next? What does the governor says the next step? Because they're both saying what the other is doing is likely unconstitutional.
Right. And so the next step is this is going to go to court, and a court's going to have to decide this. And the governor says that, you know, he feels like it is fully unconstitutional. And there are public health organizations, agencies coming out saying this would hurt if there was a huge problem where they needed to shut something down real quick to prevent, you know, some sort of huge widespread disease or something that went wrong in a community, that they would not be able to do that because their hands would be tied. And they all wrote, there were a lot of them who wrote the governor and said, you know, wrote the legislature and said, hey, you know what, we cannot be dealing with this apparatus. We have to move quickly, and you're preventing us from doing that. And they were very outspoken on this. So I expect a court battle.
Julie, could you just take us back maybe to a year ago when everything was starting to unfold? How would that have been done differently with this new law?
Well, DeWine and his then health director, Amy Acton, put in a number of emergency orders that affected all Ohioans. I mean, there was a state shutdown. There was a delay of the election, if you recall. There were various incremental changes that were restricting people. And those were basically in place until DeWine or Amy Acton decided to lift them. And so what would change now would be like there would be a duration of 60 days. Now, you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but I think under this bill, you know, 2 months, and then each 2 months they would have to come back and they would have to ask again, and the legislature would get to have some kind of a say. Now, they could extend it, but they would, you know, they would have to do that incrementally rather than what we saw, which was basically, you know, we've had an emergency in place for a year.
Right. Right. So it's good. It's going to go to court. Does that mean the law won't go into effect, do you think, Jackie Borchardt?
Well, this bill was passed without an emergency clause, so it already has a 90-day period before it takes effect. And then I believe even in the bill, it has a mechanism to terminate the current state of emergency, but that doesn't even take effect until 30 days after the bill takes effect. So we're looking at, you know, 4 months from now before that would happen. And in addition to a possible lawsuit, which there's some question of who would bring that and who would defend whom in that scenario, because, you know, you've got two state interests there with the governor and the legislature, and Attorney General Dave Yost is also a state official who usually defends both. So, but anyway, in addition to any sort of legal challenge, there's the very real possibility that in 90 days, we won't have any state health orders. You know, the governor has set a benchmark to reach and has said that everything will go away by then, but by the time we reach that, which is 50 new cases per 100,000 residents during the last 2 weeks. We're pretty far from that mark. I think we're around 147 as of last Thursday. But there's nothing preventing the governor from continuing to roll back restrictions as we see that number improve, which is something that the administration has left open. Or even, you know, he could just repeal them before before this takes effect. So it's one of those things where, you know, even if it's not challenged in court and it does take effect, it might not even might be moot by then.
It might be moot by then. But what about the next time? I mean, one of the things they told us throughout this is that we're going to start having pandemics increasingly. It's not going to be this. It's not going to be 100 years from now as the next one. And the governor had said he's worried about future administrations, how they're able to manage it. And I guess, you know, we heard Republican Representative Scott Wiggum of Wayne County at the top of the hour, saying that the General Assembly is the only policymaking authority identified by the Ohio Constitution. So you could virtually argue that the governor's ongoing year-long orders and rules are actually unconstitutional, end quote. All right. What? I mean, the governor's there's executive policy made all the time. Julie Carr Smyth, what's he talking about?
Yeah, it's a very odd argument to make because as you say, I mean, the governor wrote a lengthy letter laying out all the things that the administrative branch does in this state with regard to orders. It includes quarantines for food contamination and for storm emergencies and all kinds of other alerts. Maybe water we had the water crisis in Toledo a few years ago, and you know, health departments have to be able to be nimble in that way. And what's interesting to me about the backstory of the bill is that, you know, it has all these provisions that are just opening up the state to lawsuits at the local level rather than at the Franklin County level. And, you know, some groups have been frustrated that they can't sue and win on this against DeWine. And so the bill kind of makes that possible for them. And that may be where they have to go back in. I know Bill Seitz suggested, you know, we might have to revisit some provisions of this. And once they go back in, maybe, you know, things change in 4 months.
Yeah, because it doesn't just name the state, it also names local health departments.
Right.
So if a local health department wants to issue an order of any type, you know, emergency orders, they too would have to go before the Ohio General Assembly in some fashion that we don't yet know or understand yet to get it extended?
That's the danger in this. That's the way, you know, they're...
That's like a full-time job for whatever... Whatever body is established right. In the Ohio General Assembly, all things being equal, I mean, again, it won't come into play until there's an actual emergency, but it would apply not just to health. Well, it would be emergency orders, period, right?
Okay. Yeah. And you never know when you're going to have an emergency. Don't know what kind of emergency you're going to have. And they're really concerned that they can't just go to the governor and say, hey, you know, we have this issue. In fact, right now, I know in Delaware County, they've issued emergencies, and in Franklin County, they issue emergencies all the time because something's wrong with the water or there's, you know, some kind of thing happening. And they're saying, well, you know, that's what they're concerned about is that they cannot go and issue those emergencies easily under this new law.
Right. And the political talking point that's interesting is that, you know, they want to say that you cannot, the government cannot quarantine you, if you want to use that word. You know, we've all been under lockdown unless you have a positive medical diagnosis. And if you think about it, I mean, that's not how quarantines work. I mean, exposure is the point at which people are quarantined to prevent infection. And then once you're clear of your quarantine and you're not, it turns out you don't have it, or maybe you have it and you get better. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of cases, you don't have it. But you've come back from, say, China or Europe or somewhere else where all of a sudden some virus was spreading. The government wouldn't be able to do that at all under this bill unless you had a positive diagnosis.
There was another.
And I think it's important to note that that's already happening in Ohio with the Ebola virus, where, you know, there's a couple dozen people who have not tested positive for Ebola. They don't necessarily have it yet, but they have returned from a country that is experiencing outbreak. And so they are, you know, being quarantined and monitored and will be released from that. And if they are found to not have it.
Just three Republicans, two Republican senators and one member of the House voted against the override. Can we summarize what their objections were to it? Anybody? Julie? Okay.
A lawmaker, and this happens with other vetoes, overrides, lawmakers may feel strongly about the bill, but they just don't feel like the legislature should be overriding the governor on something.
Okay.
And rather it you know, take another direction.
It's so. Sort of the principle of it is that's what they right. oppose.
Well, in this idea that, you know, the DeWine administration did come forward with a compromise. They wanted to see if he could sign the bill and then not be sending the whole state into court over this. And so, you know, there's a sort of a feeling among some like, hey, this is what government does. You know, we compromise with the governor and then we all try to get along, that it's bad for the party since everybody's Republican to be fighting your own Republican governor.
And then just one last point on this is, you know, what public opinion is on it. And I'm wondering if the governor, what his calculations are in taking this to court to clear the air once and for all about whether this is legal or not because of voters. Jackie Borchardt, any feelings about that or thoughts about that, that he might not take it to court? And just, you know, kick the can down the road, as they say.
I don't see him being of that mind. Okay. Given that he's said multiple times that he would. I think there's a scenario where he wouldn't if I don't think he would. I think he okay. will. And if it's not, like I said earlier, it's kind of, we don't know yet how a lawsuit would be brought, right? If it would be from the governor or if it would be, you know, from a local health department or a citizen, or, you know, there's many different ways you could go about doing this. You got to make sure, you know, that whoever sues has standing to sue right. and that the lawsuit can actually go forward. So I'm imagining there's a lot of that kind of discussion going on right now in the governor's office of how to challenge it.
We will continue our conversation. It is our weekly reporter roundtable, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smythe, Statehouse Correspondent for the Associated Press. Lieutenant Governor Husted has faced some criticism over the weekend from the Asian American community and allies after he referred to the quote-unquote Wuhan virus in a tweet. He didn't exactly apologize. Jackie Borchardt, what's going on with Lieutenant Governor John Husted?
Well, the Lieutenant Governor on Friday night tweeted out an article about former CDC Director Robert Redfield, who had given an interview to CNN in which he said that it was his opinion that the coronavirus came from a lab leak in Wuhan. And during the interview, he didn't, he was straight up and said, I don't have evidence of this necessarily, but I think this is what I believe. I think that's more likely than say the virus, you know, leaping from an animal to a human. And, you know, lots of outlets ran with this story after the interview. It came before the WHO released a report today indicating that they believe it did jump from an animal to humans. And the evidence that they have supports that theory. But anyway, so he tweeted it out and said, you know, looks like maybe it was the Wuhan virus after all. And that phrase, Wuhan virus, for over a year now, the World Health Organization, scientists, people in the Asian American community have, you know, encouraged people to not use phrases like that, to not use terms to describe the virus that refer to it originating in China or Wuhan. And actually, the World Health Organization back in 2015 issued a pretty pretty in-depth guidance on how to name new diseases. Now, of course, you know, what about the German measles or the Spanish flu? And of course, like, that's been the tradition for hundreds of years to kind of name a disease where you think it originated from. But, you know, there's been growing acceptance of the idea that that is, can be very harmful to the communities that that then, you know, care, are associated with an infectious disease. So that's why there's this guidance. That's why back in February of 2020, the unofficial decision was made to call it SARS-CoV-2, the virus, and then the disease that it causes, COVID-19, for, you know, coronavirus disease 19 for 2019 for the year. And so that's the standard phrase. That's what, you know, in the media we've been following since then. And so I think a lot of people in the Asian American community and allies were surprised to see the lieutenant governor, who's been kind of, you know, at the forefront of the state's response, use that term that, you know, has been seen to be derogatory and used in a derogatory way.
You know, speaking of that, as far as being in the forefront, I'm kind of wondering, you know, given Senate Bill 22 and all of this, is if hypothetically the governor, they take the, you know, they, you know, the you know, it goes to court or whatever, is the governor and lieutenant governor, would they still have their daily, I mean, who would be in charge, I guess, is what I'm kind of wondering with all of that.
That's a good question, Ann. I don't know. And they're not really having their daily briefing anyway anymore.
Yeah.
It's come down to, you know, a couple times a week, basically. I don't know. I think that's why everyone's so concerned, because they don't, it's not really spelled out what role would be played by the governor, the lieutenant governor, in all this.
Okay, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and also with us Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press and Jackie Borchardt of the USA Today Network, Ohio. Julie, legislation that would eliminate consumer-based fees for nuclear plants and other fees related to House Bill 6, the nuclear bailout law, has landed on the governor's desk. This is kind of the piecemeal approach by the Ohio General Assembly, right, to undoing whatever they did with House Bill 6. What's going on? Is he going to sign it? Do we know?
Well, the interesting thing is that, you know, the fees and everything that were part of the original House Bill 6 were all in question anyway. So this is kind of a piecemeal, kind of wimpy decision to take a stand at this point, because, you know, already Energy Harbor, which now operates those plants, has said we probably don't want the money. Another set of the fees has been knocked down in court because Dave Yost took made a lawsuit against it. So, you know, I don't know. I can't say whether DeWine is going to sign it, but it looks like, you know, they want to look as if they've done something to react to this before the next election, actually, because, you know, they have this scandal on their hands and they're trying to figure out how to free themselves from it.
You know, and what about Neil Clark, the former super lobbyist charged for his role in the $61 million bribery scandal associated with House Bill 6? Any news about that investigation? They've said at the time they suspected suicide. Any confirmation on anything?
I just actually checked on that in a report this morning, and at least the sheriff's office hasn't released it yet. What we know is that he was found with a gun nearby, near his car. And I think that the police have said that's what they think that it is, which tells me, you know, was it related to the investigation? I mean, I guess we won't know because he's gone, but, you know, maybe it was a factor. Just looking down the road at those charges, and with householders seeming to be stable and back in the House, you know, is, you know, is, are, were they looking for someone else to hang charges on, or who might have been more culpable? We don't really know, but, you know, those are all speculations.
So I guess I'm just, there's another piece of this, Sam Randazzo, former Public Utilities Commission of Ohio chairman, former utilities lawyer and lobbyist. You wrote about First Energy Corporation paying him $4.3 million before he was appointed to the PUCO. Any updates with that? They raided his house early morning, I believe in February. It might have been in early March. I can't remember. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, what we know is that there were a couple conflicting things in First Energy's federal filings, and they aren't speaking to it beyond what's been written. But one said, yes, you know, the $4.3 million was spent to terminate a contract, which was interesting enough because it went back to 2013. So here was somebody who was working for First Energy, but not publicly so. And in another report, they used the word after, meaning that he that paid for services after the payment was made. And that would have been in January of 2019 that he got the money. And then the next month he was appointed. So what we looked at was all the various things that happened during Sam Randazzo's tenure on the commission that helped First Energy, including his help on House Bill 6, including the decoupling of its profits from any actual performance so that they could keep those steady. And that was worth millions of dollars. And there were a few other things. So,
and ordinarily, disclosure of this would have been expected so that you could recuse yourself or there could be discussion about recusal.
Right. And what we had known before and reported was that this dossier made its way to DeWine before he appointed Randazzo that laid a lot of this out and said, Sam Randazzo has conflicts of interest, don't appoint him. And DeWine appointed him anyway. So it's really, you know, what happens next with Randazzo? I think something will happen next with Randazzo. And of course, we have several First Energy executives who have been fired. Who are named in the reports, you know, because the company itself is trying to survive at this point. They're trying to offload anybody who acted wrongly.
There's a lot of tentacles, Jackie Borchardt, here. It makes it difficult to talk about, but it is very important. It's called the biggest bribery scandal in state history, $61 million, I guess. I don't know. You got to really think about that. But a lot of tentacles leading all the way to the governor's office on this.
Yeah, I think that's also what makes it so difficult for us to report and also for probably investigators as well, because there's just it seems that it's very like you said, it goes into the governor's office. You know, the governor, he has said over and over again, though, that you know, campaign contributions that he got from First Energy did not influence his decision on this bill, that he had promised during his campaign that he was going to support a solution that kept the plants open. But, you know, since then, we have learned that, you know, there was a lot more money, including some dark money that was being funneled behind the scenes to support the governor and to support his daughter, as well as, you know, DeWine's chief lobbyist was a former First Energy lobbyist. I mean, there's all sorts of connections. And then at this point, too, in the case is, yes, we have the federal investigation, but we also, at least involving First Energy, there are several audits that are ongoing. There are lawsuits from shareholders. The PUCO is investigating whether ratepayers, whether, you know, our utility bills that we pay, whether that has went to any of this. There's the FERC is investigating this money as well,
the
including
federal,
the payment to Randazzo. I mean, it's just it's it's spread out over, there's bankruptcy court still from for First Energy Solutions, the company that now is called Energy Harbor that actually owns the two plants. So it's just, it's massive. It is so, I can't even, like I said, describe accurately just how massive it is. And I think we're kind of still at the top of the iceberg. And, you know, outgoing U.S. attorney Dave DeBiller has even said as much a week or so ago that, you know, a lot of work in his office has kind of been slowed down by the pandemic. They haven't been able to convene grand juries for a chunk of time. Right. And so now that that will start picking up, then I think we can expect to see some more movement, at least on that front in this scandal.
Neil Clark, the now deceased, was supposed to be writing a self-published book, volume, memoir of his time. I mean, and he was around for 30, easily, you know, almost 40 years at the State House, and a super lobbyist for much of it, and deeply entrenched with the Republicans in at least the Senate for his early part of his career. He understood the budget and how it worked and how to make money lobbying around it better than anybody. And he has this book coming out. I know there's something out there. I know it's going to be self-published. Has anybody had any access to anything in that?
I've seen the cover.
Oh, you've seen the cover.
Supposed cover.
Okay. What's the title?
What do I know? I'm just a lobbyist. So I don't know. I think that's the question. What, you know, is there a book and what's in it is a question on many minds around Cap Square.
I have heard that it's not so much a tell-all as it is just sort of a memoir, a goodbye letter almost, of just, he did a lot of things. I mean, after Neil died, I was sort of trying to review a few things and talk to some people who knew him well. And, you know, one of the things he did was help get money for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the right. budget, which was one of his clients, and other things like that, that, you know, he was behind a lot of the big deals.
Exactly.
It's
sad, really, really sad. Politico reported last week that the governor held an apprentice style audition for U.S. Senate hopefuls Josh Mandel, James Timken, and two others in Florida. Have you guys heard about that and what was going on?
I think you meant former President Trump did that.
Former President Trump, yes.
Yeah. I read that Politico article and I think they described it as the Hunger Games. But, you know, it's definitely sounds like it was a lively meeting, one that would be interesting to be on the fly on the wall. And apparently, former Ohio Republican Party Chairman Jane Timken and former Treasurer Josh Mandel, they were the ones who were doing most of the speaking. Apparently, President Trump was kind of asking Timken about her comments early on supporting Congressman Anthony Gonzalez, and then she backed away from that and she said that, you know, she had fixed those. But there was just a lot of tension, it sounds like, in that room during, you know, if you read that article.
Yeah, he basically, they were down in Florida for a fundraiser, and apparently Trump was there and said, hey, you know, they all want my endorsement. Let me just bring them all in a room and talk to them all at once, which is obviously highly unusual. But apparently this is how he's going to roll now. And so you can imagine the Hunger Games reference being like, you're just there in front of the guy who you're all trying to get his endorsement, and he's grilling you about, you know, your positions. And the interesting thing is that everybody was in the room. It included Timken and Mandel, as well as two other self-funded candidates, Mike Gibbons Bernie Moreno from up in Cleveland. And all of them, you know, have some reason to hope for an endorsement from Trump, because they've all been, you know, generous donors. And Mike Gibbons helped with you know, set up a super PAC and ran ads for Trump. And Josh Mandel was the first state official to endorse. And obviously Timken won the state for Trump twice by over 8 percentage points. So, you know, will he even endorse at all? Apparently they all left the room and nobody had the endorsement. But, you know, the best so far that could be hoped for is that they're batting away some decision by Trump and that he doesn't endorse anybody.
It reminded me, I once had like a group job interview and it reminded me of that, where I was like in the room with the same, with other candidates for the job. And it's just such a, when I read that story, that's immediately brought me back to that scenario, because it's such an intense situation on its own. And then to have the person who's interviewing you be the president, former president of the United States, who could basically like bless your campaign or totally rip it to shreds with an email, you know, statement released via email. So that story, widely read in Ohio political circles for that reason.
We will return. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jackie Borchardt, USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press State House Bureau. Attorney General Dave Yost last week said he will appeal a dismissal of his lawsuit seeking quicker release of census counts for the redistricting purpose. For the redistricting process, that is redrawing the district, the congressional district lines for Ohio. What was the basis for the ruling by Judge Thomas Rose? Jackie Borchardt?
Well, he said they didn't have standing, that they, you know, couldn't, that they didn't have standing to sue. So, the Attorney General has said that he's appealing that and will press forward to try to get that data early. And, you know, that the data is usually delivered in December of the census year. And it was already delayed 3 months because of COVID. And then, you know, last month, the census said, well, actually we probably won't, we're setting the new deadline for ourselves of September 30th. And that, you know, conflicts with our new deadlines. And underlying all of this is that we're doing a new process this year to draw our lines for the state house districts and for our congressional house districts. There were already a lot of questions about how that would work and how that would go. And it's supposed to, you know, be more transparent and allow a lot of opportunities for the public to weigh in. And so there's a big concern from some of the advocates that fought for these reforms that some of that will be minimized if we still try to rush things through the constitutional deadlines.
But advocates also want to make sure the numbers are correct, right, Julie Carr-Smythe? I mean, they want to get the numbers correct, and they say there's other stuff you could be doing. You don't have to just sit and wait for these numbers to come out.
Right, because, the thing was that the Census Bureau obviously was impeded by the virus, and Trump at one point tried to sort of shut things down, and people advocated for, you know, let's keep going on that end of it, on the collection end, to make sure we have a thorough set of numbers, because people hadn't been able to get to all the homes. You know, there's this process where everybody can voluntarily report, and then whoever hasn't gets a door knock, and, you know, people try to get as close to 100% as they can. There is a lot that can be done. There's a committee that could be convened. There are discussions that could go. A lot of this is philosophy, honestly. It has to do with, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? What are you going to crack districts? Are you going to keep them together? Do you want neighborhoods together? Do you want counties together, et cetera? And, you know, there's a lot of that you could still do knowing what we know. I mean, the census does have interim data that they put out periodically. I mean, I use it in my stories all the time. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's not perfect, but you know, the other thing the judge said was it wasn't quite, you know, what can they do? Because the census isn't ready and it has to be, it has to go to all this, the groups at the same time.
It's just one of those years, right?
Right.
It's like, it's not going to be ready.
Another thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So there is a transportation budget that is expected to pass. Any big disputes between Republicans and Democrats or between the executive and the legislative branch at this point? Is it pretty boilerplate? What's going on? Jackie, do you know?
Yeah, so they did pass it out, moved out of both chambers. I think you got the final House vote on Thursday.
Oh, okay.
And there was some debate over the provisions between the House and the Senate, and they were trying to work that out so that they could pass it and go home and not have to come back with a conference committee of members of both chambers. And there were some big changes from Governor DeWine's proposal. I think the biggest one dollar-wise was certainly the money for public transit. That was in the bill. You know, the governor had proposed, taking it back a little bit in the last budget, Ohio got a huge boost in public transit dollars. In this budget, Governor DeWine had only, you know, he'd proposed it would amounted to like a 90% cut in the funding. So right away, I think lawmakers saw that and said, well, no, we need to definitely restore some of that funding. And it ended up with $140 million over 2 years, $221 million if you add the federal money on top of that. I think some members, especially in urban areas, would have wanted more funding, but that's certainly an improvement. And they also took out some of the policy changes that the governor had proposed, such as making, we have a law on the books against using your cell phone while you drive, but it's not a primary offense, which means that you can't get pulled over for that offense. You have to be speeding or running a red light or doing something else to get pulled over. And then that charge gets tacked on if that's what you're doing. And the governor wanted to make that again, and he's proposed this before, wanted to make it a primary offense. And lawmakers stripped that out as well.
Right. Senate President Matt Huffman said it would infringe on drivers' liberties like wearing a seatbelt does. I'm not sure what he's talking about there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing, but, you know, seatbelts are still a secondary offense, though, I think, so we're a liberty state, Anne. What are you talking about?
local control liberty state. Yeah. Oh, you know what? I forgot to ask about Dr. Amy Acton. She has not declared for the U.S. Senate Democratic primary, but she keeps racking up money. The 314 Action Fund has dangled $5 million. Now, of course, no matter what, it's going to be a hugely expensive race. But I wanted to get your thoughts. I mean, do you think Amy, I don't know. It's. I feel like she's just has people out there on tenterhooks at this point waiting to decide. Any thoughts? Joe Ingles, let's start with you. What do you think?
Well, she hasn't said no. So, right. I mean, as long as she doesn't say no and she's still out there as a possibility, there are a lot of people who look at her as a potential person to go run for office because she did have pretty high popularity ratings last year during the coronavirus. And, I think a lot of people thought that she might be a good one to run. I think there's a consensus that it might be nice to have a woman who has some of her background as the candidate. But on the Democratic side, it's really funny because we've also got Tim Ryan, who has been thought as a possible person to run for that office. And, you know, he's kind of toyed with it. And this whole thing we were talking about, the drawing the lines, I mean, Tim Ryan, Congressman, is in a district that could be affected by the line drawing process. So, I mean, there's a whole lot out there. Nothing's moving right now on the Democratic side. But as you said, she continues to get money.
But I mean, we are a little early, you know, I mean, it's still a little ways off. And I think that April tends to be, you know, a month where a lot of people are tend to announce, because then they have a full quarter to raise money before they have to report. You know, I think she's seriously considering it. And as Joe said, I mean, she became this household name. She probably has better recognition than Ryan, Mandel, Tim can put together at this point. Yeah. And 314 Action, interestingly, is a group that they recruit people with science backgrounds. And one of their philosophies, I guess, is that, you know, there are some professions where they naturally tend toward legislator, obviously lawyers, because they make laws, and also their firms give them time off to run and to be in politics, and it's a cachet kind of within that field, whereas scientists are in labs or they're in classrooms, and but it's taken off in some parts of the country, showing that voters do want this kind of thing, you know, for the very reason that pandemics sometimes hit. And, you know, we have people in government, and go back to the top of your show and what Amelia Sykes said. I mean, there's this growing feeling that, you know, we need to have a government that understands science.
What do you think, Jackie?
Yeah, $5 million is not an insignificant amount in a primary. You know, we in Ohio I'm trying to think the last open seat, I think, was Portman seat, right? Where we had primaries on either side. And that was, you know, pre or around like Citizens United was not a thing. So had this, all this outside money. I remember in 2012 in the Mandel Brown race, everyone was kind of stunned by all this outside money. And I don't think that even the total of that was 5 million. So I think this is, in addition to being, would be good news for Amy Acton. I think it's a sign too, that we're going to see a ton of money in this state for this next election. In the primary, that, like I said, that would be a huge chunk of money. But looking at the races like from 2020 and 2018 in other states, I mean, just upwards, Atlanta, the Georgia races were, I think, an anomaly, because that was, they were their own thing for a while. And that was just, you know, I think over $100 million or something crazy like that on those races. But I think we can expect this to be the costliest race in history. Without a doubt, it will be. And this outside money will be a huge component of both the primary and the general race.
Now, since we last spoke, the president has had his first press conference with the State House press. I mean, White House press corps. And Julie, thumbs up, thumbs down. And who is on trial here, the president or the press corps?
Well, within the trade press last week, I mean, there was just a lot of discussion about the fact that the journalists didn't really rise to the occasion. You know, here it was hyped incredibly with, you know, the history of all press conferences, and the number of days was the most of any president to not have a news conference, even though he's already had a national address and things like that. But then when they got him in the room, you know, there was a lot of dwelling on sort of the same issue. You got the feeling that folks came in with a pre-written question. I mean, we're all guilty of that. You think what you're going to ask because you're on national television or whatever. And so, you know, pre-written question, and they couldn't pivot when it had already been asked. So they asked three times about immigration. They did not ask about guns with two mass shootings in the previous week. They barely asked about COVID. They asked twice whether he was going to run for re-election, which was just, I mean, why would he say no when he's not even 100 days in, you know?
What did you think, Jackie? We're running out of time. I don't mean to rush you.
So I didn't watch it in real time because I was doing some work on Ohio politics and doing my job. Sorry. But I kind of caught up with it later. And I mean, it's frustrating me as a reporter because I have a list of questions I would ask the president if I got him in a room and those weren't asked. But I also kind of, I empathize a little bit because just in the last year with our press conferences with the governor being televised. You know, sometimes you ask a question and it may seem like it makes no sense during the press conference, but it's, you know, for another story you're working on. I do hope, and I've done this before, where I've got a list of questions and someone asks my question, oh, I cross it off the list. So, you know, I wish we could ask questions. You know, the president was here last week and the local press didn't get to ask any questions.
We are out of time, Joe. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
It's what they said.
Okay,
exactly.
What they said. Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. And Jackie Borchardt, USA Today Network Ohio Bureau Chief. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.